special thanks to Bob for today, because he literally had to rearrange his entire schedule to accommodate me. I really greatly appreciate that. Sometimes things come up, you do what you have to do. I was ready to do whatever I had to do, no matter what. Unless a hurricane blows me over or something. Well, no hurricanes in Chicago. Just freezing cold weather. Today it's a little bit better. A terrible winter, but that's another story entirely. There are major things going on in the world. There is no question what the number one story is. I mean, when the U.S. media covers something, even when they get it all wrong and simply lie to their viewers and their readers, which, of course, is what they only do, manage news misinformation, the kind of rubbish that too many people still believe in, although few in numbers all the time. When they cover a story and stay on it on a daily basis, you know it's not some small-time stuff. It's major. And I'm talking about Ukraine. It's not the only major story. We'll get into another one in the hour as well, what's going on in Venezuela, because Venezuela is kind of a lower-level example of what has been going on in Ukraine that very, very much continues in Ukraine. I've literally been writing daily articles on Ukraine. I'm writing a lot about Venezuela as well. Yesterday I wrote two Ukraine articles. This morning I wrote one. I decided to write a second one because stuff is happening. News is breaking. Literally, I mean, I was literally in the middle of doing something else when I got the word that Vladimir Putin, who's been uncharacteristically quiet to much of what's been going on in recent weeks. Well, that changed. He asked Russia's upper house, its Federation Council, to authorize the use of Russia's military forces in Crimean territory, not to go to war, to protect the safety and the security of Russian nationals in the area, which he has every right to do. And it's in a 1997 agreement between Ukraine and Russia signed, I'm sorry, a 2010. There is another separate 1997 agreement. It's a friendship agreement, and I wrote about it in one of my articles. There's a separate agreement in 2010 where both countries signed by the presidents of Ukraine and Russia that what Putin asked the Federation Council to do is perfectly permissible. Again, not as an act of aggression, as an act of public safety. Well, this morning, the Federation Council discussed it. I can't really call it a debate because they voted unanimously to approve what Putin asked for. It's in Russia's constitution. It's Article 102. I cited from it, and they'll go. What the numbers are, I don't know, but they will go. Of course, I think as listeners know, Russia's Black Sea Fleet is based in Crimea, mainly in Sevastopol, non-belligerent. It's part of an agreement that runs between Russia and Ukraine till at least 2042. I saw two different dates. One was 2042, the other was 2047. Well, that's a long time in the future. In other words, they're there interminably as of now. And I can't imagine Russia ever being willing to give up its warm water port. It won't give it up. It'll defend it. And Putin is no mollycoddle. He is very forceful. He's very forthright. I can only say, thank heavens for Vladimir Putin. Is he perfect? No. No. But geopolitically, he stands for things like believing rule of law principles are inviolable. And so isn't national sovereignty. He says it. He believes it. He hasn't threatened any other country, hasn't attacked any other country, hasn't invaded any other country. He has no intention of doing anything like that. He wants peace and stability, but he's got a problem on his hands. He has to deal with Obama and the criminal element in Washington. He has to deal with the threat that literally escalates daily. The title of one of my articles yesterday was Ukraine, Potential Flashpoint for Global War. Well, literally, the tension increases. The chance for East-West confrontation grows just about on a daily basis. And I've begun to use a phrase, and I'm going to use it over and over again. It's, quote, the damn fool in the White House. I don't have to tell you who that is. The damn fool in the White House. I don't give a damn where he went to school. Columbia, Harvard Law School. He's a damn fool. He has no idea what in hell he's doing. He's literally risking World War III. I don't say that lightly. Bob, I want to make one more comment and then let you jump in. Am I in my entire lifetime, I literally entered kindergarten on or about the day Hitler invaded Poland and World War II began. I was only 5 years old. Of course, I had no idea what was going on. Nothing at all. And it certainly took me a while to realize there was something big going on when my dad kept listening to the news every night when he came home from work. I began to catch on very slowly. But a five-year-old kid doesn't understand anything. Never in my entire life, when I was old enough to understand things, was I ever scared about a possible very, very serious East-West confrontation, except very briefly during the so-called missiles of October 1962. But note the difference. Then we had Jack Kennedy as president, and we later learned, and I quoted Kennedy saying, he had no intention with starting a war with Russia, no intention in the world. Obama is no Jack Kennedy. He's somebody to be scared about because he's a damn fool, and his administration is infested with neocons. Neocons, as bad as the Bush administration. There's no telling what these crazies will do. Kennedy had to deal with crazies like General Curtis LeMay, who wanted to nuke Russia back to the Stone Age. And he once, and I mentioned this in an article I wrote, he once in the middle of a national security meeting that I think LeMay was there and another U.S. general, Lemenser, I think his name was, he wanted to do the same thing, not nuke. He wanted to attack Cuba. He wanted the second Bay of Pigs on Cuba. And Kennedy was so incensed, he did what I imagine no other U.S. president ever did before him or after. He got up in the middle of the meeting and he stormed out angrily, and I think he did it in a way that the people there realized he was absolutely furious, and he wanted them to know it. Again, Obama is no Jack Kennedy. We really have a mess in our hands, Bob.
We do, Stephen, and you've been talking about Obama being a fool, and I haven't looked at him so much as a fool as much as a tool of the CIA and the military-industrial complex. But going back to what you said a moment ago, I have a couple of comments in response. I don't think it's at all irresponsible at this point to assert that we're on the brink of World War III. And Ukraine is the flashpoint. But if it's not Ukraine, then you look at China and the Southeast Asian area that Obama is playing with right now and provoking. Then you look at Syria, and you look at Greece and Egypt, and you look at Venezuela and what Israel is doing. In each of these cases, it's the U.S. that is provoking the conflict. In each of these cases, it is the goal of U.S. hegemony that drives the provocations. In each of these cases, it seems to me the hegemonic concerns are driven by the greed of the capitalist economic elites. In each of these cases, it's a war against the people, meant to keep the people down economically, socially, and politically in favor of the hegemonic control of the elites. In each of these cases, it's authoritarian rule, and sometimes totalitarian rule, that is either the means or the ends of the U.S. provocations and their positions. And I'll just conclude with this. In every case, when commentators and analysts are talking about this, any of these areas, outside of the neocons and the Democratic and Republican Party flacks or Obama shills, they're warning that we are now in an extremely dangerous game playing with nuclear-armed Russia and nuclear-armed China. And in part, it's because the U.S. can't control the forces of violence they're unleashing. The fascists that they're setting up in Ukraine, for example, love to go to war. And in fact, the news early this morning was that the interim government has now asked the United States and Britain to come to its military aid, accusing Russia of invading them. Even though we don't have any evidence at all that that's happened, he actually has put on his Facebook, this is the new Interior Minister, Avakov is his name. He says, Russia has invaded, and I regard this as an armed invasion and occupation in violation of all international treaties and norms. That is a provocation. And Obama is just enough of a tool of the Pentagon to pick up and run with that, even though there's no evidence for that. So you've got Putin on the one hand, as you now say, has gotten the Russia's Upper House Federation to authorize the use of force. And here is the Ukrainian fascist government saying to the United States, come over from the west and start pushing your way in this way because Russia's coming from the east. There is the flashpoint.
Bob, it certainly is a flashpoint. Putin didn't authorize the use of force.
It was the Upper House Federation that to authorize use of forces,
forces
in Ukraine,
forces,
right?
I'm sorry, forces as opposed to force. In other words, a protection, a security force, not a belligerent force. I mean, the last thing Putin wants is an East-West confrontation, but he may get it even though he doesn't want it. And I agree with you about Obama, absolutely agree with you on Obama. I mean, he literally is a tool of the power structure that runs America, the Pentagon, and the moneyed interests, the people that profit from wars, Bob, as we know. I mean, the bankers profit, the defense contractors profit, all the big U.S. corporations profit, because when America goes to war, you know, you got to supply the forces with everything. So everybody gets a piece of the pie, they make money, and they love wars, and that certainly is one reason why America fights them. There hasn't been a single day of peace, not a single day of peace, from day one in Obama's tenure to today. And I must say the same thing was true about George Bush. And I must say also you could go back to past presidents and say the same thing. The difference is the degree of risk and the number of conflicts that are involved. And since Bush in 2001 to this very moment, America has been involved in more multiple conflicts, more dangerous ones, especially now, than other presidents, except, you know, during World War II. World War One, my goodness, World War One, America got in just with a year to go or so. My dad was in World War One in France. I wasn't around during that time, but I've certainly written about World War One and World War Two. But we're on a very dangerous, a slippery slope, Bob. I agree. I don't think either side wants World War Three. Did either side want World War One? Did either side want World War Two? I can't imagine anybody wants something that bad that you could end up losing. So I think the same scenario holds now, but you may end up with something you'll get even though you may not want it, and that's the danger.
That's the real danger, that this whole idea that it comes down to American arrogance in some respects, because the whole time that Obama is holding Russia to account for international law, China's the same thing too, by the way, holding them to account to international law, holding them to account for engaging in peaceful and negotiated purposes, at the very same time, Washington continues to push its own economic interest in Eastern Europe and in China by knocking off governments and installing their own governments, interfering with these other governments, thinking that no one is going to push back against this, or that if anyone did, as Dick Cheney said about Iraq, this will be a short and easy fight and it'll be all over with. But that whole arrogance of power that keeps pushing and pushing and pushing is exactly why these flashpoints are all being set up now. That the end result of that could very well be that suddenly it all flashes up in a flame. And that's what I was saying earlier, that the U.S. can't control these forces that they're setting in motion. I mean, you support the Islamic radicals in Syria and the fascists in Ukraine, and you try to foment the same type of thing in Africa and around the world in various places by getting these really radical, violent groups and giving them money and weapons. I mean, the United States is spending $20 million a week arming the Ukrainian opposition groups. So when you do that, you lose control, just like the moderates lost control in the Ukraine protest very early on. The United States is going to lose control of all this. We're sending off too many little flames here or there, little flashes here and there, and those are going to come back to haunt us. And that's why I think that this whole idea of Russia's response with Putin asking the Federation to authorize the use of armed forces, that could be a very, very telling moment. And that just happened. So, and this is very interesting how quickly this has happened. I mean, these big flashes have come about in the month of February. So now we're into March, and now Russia's taken the first step to respond. That could be a big issue. And the UN has been playing the role of U.S. instrument all along. So this is going to be really interesting to see how this plays out.
Oh, it sure is, Bob. I believe it was the 17th of March that Bush went to war against Iraq in 2003. It wasn't March. It was mid-January that we had the Gulf War. I remember that so well that I don't remember exactly where I was when the 2003 war began. The Gulf War, for some reason I remember that. I think it was on the 16th of January in 1991. I know exactly where I was. I was at an event I was involved in at a hotel, And, I mean, I was busy with what I was doing. Then all of a sudden people were buzzing around talking about things unrelated to my program that I was putting on, which I was not too happy about. I wanted attention focused on business at hand. But when I found out what happened, I realized what all the buzz was about, and it certainly caught my attention, and I wanted to get in front of a TV set for a few moments just to see what kind of reports were coming across. And indeed, George Senior Bush's war on Iraq began, and Iraq has literally been in conflict ever since. And if anybody thinks the war in Iraq is over with, they're very, very much mistaken. Iraq remains a cauldron of violence where dozens of people are dying every single day, car bombs exploding, people getting shot, just a horrific stuff going on. And the country was literally, the cradle of civilization, as it's called, was literally transformed into a dystopian backwater, ravaged, destroyed. Same thing in Libya, Bob. Same thing in Afghanistan with that war, easily by far the longest war in U.S. history. And if a way isn't found to stop it, it could go on for another decade, maybe two decades. Again, Bob, I'll use the phrase because I've kind of gotten to like the phrase. I hope it resonates enough so that the damn fool in the White House will hear me say it. But I think the damn fool is mindless enough to continue that war and maybe pass it on to a successor, and maybe we'll get another damn fool doing exactly the same thing. And if you and I are on air together a decade from now, we might be talking about the quagmire of all quagmires that never seems to end. These fighters want their country back. They want nothing to do with the U.S. occupation. It's got nothing to do with the puppet Karzai government. The topic has come up about why he refuses to go along with the status of forces agreement that Obama wants foisted on the Afghan people. In other words, to leave so many thousands of U.S. Troops behind, which means controlling bases, controlling airspace, basically running the country, and he refuses to go along. Well, why would a puppet leader that George Bush put in power, why would he refuse to go along? The only answer I can come up with, Bob, which is off the subject we're talking about, but the only thing that makes sense for me is there'll be a new election. He won't be running, so he'll leave the presidency. He may leave a lot of security behind. I'm sure he'll still have some, but not the extent of the security he has now. So he'll be less well protected, and I think he's afraid of his hide, that he's so hated in the country that if he's vulnerable in any way at all, that Afghans who hate him, Taliban, or call him anything you want, I mean, people who want their country back, are going to go after him. And he may have a very short life after he leaves office. So after 10 years, we're going along with every diktat out of Washington and causing so much harm to his own people, besides stealing multiple billions of dollars, which is strong evidence to say he's done and secreted it away in tax-free havens, he may have to pay the piper. And the piper may be his life. I think that's why he's saying, no, I won't sign this agreement with America. I think that's what the game is. I think Washington knows what it is. They'll cut him some slack. They'll wait. Well, they'll do whatever they're going to do, maybe wait for a new leader to come in, and then they'll make a deal with that leader who'll be around for a while, and Washington will probably end up with what he wants to get, and the war will continue. My God, how many wars can we put up with, Bob?
Well, it's wars of our own making, yeah. I mean, how many wars can we create in the world? But since Obama has adopted the strategy of not sending U.S. troops, but rather sending our proxies there and just feeding them money, we could do it for a long time to come because it's not really affecting us directly. It just rips up the countries that they're in. I mean, back to you had mentioned Iraq. If you want an interesting snapshot of what's going on in Iraq right now, it's certainly not a scientific study, but Muqtada al-Sadr gave a farewell speech about a week or so ago, maybe 10 days ago, where he talked about Iraq is now being run by wolves. And he goes through all the detail of all the experiences that both himself and the Iraqi people have had at the behest of the United States. And their whole idea, as he mentions, just to take over the world. And he's right. I mean, you read Zbigniew Brzezinski, somebody that I love to hate. He talks about very openly about the United States having to take over all of the world, and in order to do that, they need to take over Eurasia, and in order to do that, they must take over all of Ukraine. So that he sees Ukraine as kind of the tipping point. If Russia wins in Ukraine, then the United States loses its aspirations to be the global dominator. If we win in Ukraine, then Russia gets automatically knocked off as a world power. So he's very openly advocating, along with Victoria Nuland and her neocon husband, by the way, Robert Kagan, that Ukraine has to fall under American and NATO guidance. And so they'll do it any way they can, just like they've done in Latin America and Afghanistan and Libya and Syria and Iraq, any means necessary to do that. That's what they're going to take.
Oh, again, I agree, Bob. I absolutely agree. And I remember quoting Brzezinski on some of the things that he had to say about Ukraine. He absolutely sees Ukraine as a vital geopolitical interest, and it's whichever side gets it stands to be a big winner, as you say, and the other side is a big loser. And it's extremely, but Ukraine is more important for Russia than it is for America. My God, Ukraine shares a 1,400-kilometer border with Russia, 1,400 miles. NATO, U.S.-led NATO, I should say, is just itching to get Ukraine to become one of its member countries. 28 member countries, a good number of partner ones, Mediterranean Alliance ones, if I remember that phrase accurately. Israel is involved in, not a member country, but very much involved with NATO. And as many as a third or more of the countries in the world are tied to NATO. Well, NATO literally wants to be a global force with virtually all countries under its aegis run by Washington. When I say NATO, I really should say America, because America puts up the majority of the funding. It has the majority of control. And NATO would never go to war unless America wants the war. And then it's a U.S.-led NATO war. And indeed, Bob, the power structure in Washington, let me put it that way, is just itching to have Ukraine part of NATO, to have U.S. bases / NATO bases just right along Russia's border, nuclear-armed with long-range delivery systems, able to strike Russia preemptively before Russia can ever respond to U.S. territory. And I remember quoting Helen Caldicott, this was, I don't know how many years ago, it might have been half a dozen years ago, saying that between them, America and Russia have 97% of the world's nuclear weapons. Well, I imagine it's not that percentage now, but it may be very close to that percentage. I've used 95% in a couple of articles. I think it's a safe bet to say well over 90% of the world's nuclear weapons, sophisticated nuclear weapons, extremely powerful ones, and sophisticated delivery systems able to hit with accuracy any spot on the planet. Can you imagine these two countries facing off? China is a powerful country, but nothing up to the military level of Russia. China has a huge military forces, but you know, you can have a few million troops, and they don't mean a damn when it comes against nuclear weapons. China has nuclear weapons, has long-range delivery systems, but nothing compared to the arsenal that Russia has, and Russia had a big head start on China. But neither country wants to be an aggressor. Russia hasn't attacked anybody. China hasn't attacked anybody. They would like good relations with other countries. Again, the problem is the corrupt power structure in Washington that wants global hegemonic control. And all of those damn fools, Bob, are damn fool enough maybe to risk World War III to get it.
Oh, sure. I mean, there are a couple of things that I can think of in response to that. That a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, Paul Craig Roberts, whom I know you had as a guest,
yes,
I think last week on your show, had an article in which he talked about how the United States is willing to use any means to get to their end. And he talked about three things that the United States did in order to kind of get under the skin of Ukraine. They, first of all, had to break the Reagan-Gorbachev agreements in order to expand NATO. And then they had to withdraw from the treaty that banned anti-ballistic missiles so that they could put anti-ballistic missiles on Russia's border with Ukraine if they could. And then they changed its nuclear war option now to allow a nuclear first strike. So those are big issues right there. But then to the other thing that you ended with, that you were talking about the United States willing to engage to start up a war, the one thing that I definitely wanted to get in today was what I perceive as complete media propaganda focused so much on U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel when he introduced his new five-year budget plan for the Pentagon. The media just went hog wild about this idea that we're sending troop levels back to what we did before World War II and talking about how great that was. But they didn't talk at all about the other side of that, which is not only that he called for restoring all cuts in future military spending, not only did he say let's add back $115 billion to military spending, but he also said that we can reduce the active military in order to change our military advantage to focus against China, which will be sea, air, and cyberspace. So it's not an idea of let's reduce the forces, let's reduce the forces, the military personnel specifically. He is saying let's reduce the military personnel in order to shift to a completely retooled military so that we can attack by sea, air, and cyberspace, so we don't need our troops to do this. So the whole focus now is shifting over to a military, or to a, well, military advantage that is troopless, rely on technology instead. And one specific example that I read in the news, and one of the good analyses was, one of his proposals is to eliminate the A-10 attack aircraft. That was initially designed to destroy Soviet tanks, but now he wants to replace those with an even higher number of Apache helicopter gunships, because that you can run off of a carrier or any ship at sea in order to move in and make attacks and then come back again. So you don't need the A-10. So it's just a retooling and also an increase in budget money for the military that the media doesn't talk about. And then one of the things he mentions underneath that, when he calls for fiscal discipline in the military, he zeroes right in and talks about cutting the subsidies and the benefits for retired military personnel. So that could be cut up to 50%. Get rid of the personnel. They're costing us too much money for current salaries and also for pensions. Let's cut that back. Let's increase instead the technology and the ability to attack from the sea and from cyberspace. It's the new military. It has nothing to do with, let's just cut our troops back, yay, yay. This is, let's retool our military while continuing to raise the military budget. And that's what's not being reported.
Oh, indeed, Bob, and it's almost an analogy to that, or one part of that is the idea that as technology increases, you can get rid of piloted aircraft and replace them with drones much cheaper. Don't put human lives at risk, as if the people you're slaughtering on the ground. And same with these weapons. I mean, the weapons are so powerful, you can have powerful ships. Probably don't need as many of them. I don't know what the plans are for that. I think the Navy commanders like a lot of ships because it gives them a chance to put a lot of promote a lot of people and make them captains on the way to making them admirals. So if you have too few ships, there'll be fewer captains and fewer admirals. So the staff in the Navy doesn't like that. Well, of course, the generals may feel the same way. They may like lots of divisions. And, of course, they need wars to be able to get more stars on their shoulders. But you can get by with many fewer troops when you've got these powerful weapons. They keep getting more powerful all the time. And, of course, the real concern is the idea that a country is off the rails as America would consider using the power that they have to reach the objectives they want to achieve. And I don't think it matters at all, Bob, whether we're talking about Bush in the White House, Republicans in the White House, Obama, Democrats. I'm convinced that whoever replaces Obama in January 2017 will end up being worse than he is, unless things get so bad we may not survive until then. That would be the only exception to what I see coming, because literally, I look back, it seems as though every new administration that I can recall ended up worse than the one it succeeded. It doesn't matter whether they're Republicans or Democrats, and Democrats are often more belligerent than Republicans. My goodness.
Well, there would have to be some type of a very deep rebellion against the current type of government that we have, and that rebellion would have to be really intricate and deep-seated, because you can't just protest against Obama or Democrats or Republicans anymore. You have to go after or protest against what frequently is being called the deep state. And Mike Lofgren, I think from The Nation it was, had an article about the deep state, and then somebody followed that up with an article about the shadow lobbying complex. But the deep state is this kind of a hybrid integration of varying levels of corporate influence, millionaire influence, industry influence, the military, industrial, under the cover complex that nobody seems to be able to point to directly because they do it all in shadow. And the whole idea is, it's not even ideological, I think. I think it's just a matter of trying to get the government to do what it is that these rich people want to have done for them. And that includes Silicon Valley, too, by the way, private corporations and Silicon Valley and Wall Street. There's these there's a shadow government going on right now that's pushing this whole agenda. And so it's really kind of the idea that they meet with politicians in secret and say, we'll give you this much money, here's what we expect in response to that. And it's that whole idea that frequently is referred to getting money out of politics. It starts right there, but there's a whole octopus of underground government going on right now. And so any pushback against the government would have to go after those roots, those tentacles of the octopus, and hope that it's not cutting the head of the snake off and two more heads grow kind of thing. But that's what really has to be attacked, not the surface structure of the current constitutional issues, but what's going on underneath. That's a really serious issue. Even though there is evidence that resistance to that is growing, we don't see any end to that right now. That's what we've really got to get at. All these business money issues that are going on under the covers that we just don't know anything about.
Bob, there really is a shadow government. There are all of these things that go on, whether it's things taking place at home or abroad, especially the conflicts and the plans to topple sovereign independent governments. Plans are laid for these well in advance before anything ever happens. We'll get to Venezuela before too long, but the situation in Venezuela has been percolating for 15 years. Well, the tactics may be changing a little bit, and we can discuss them a little bit later on. We'll finish with Ukraine. But 15 years of failure. I mean, I'm astonished that something stronger wasn't initiated than the plans that began at first. They thought they almost succeeded in Venezuela in April 2002 with a coup that was aborted after 2 days. But the idea is to get rid of a sovereign independent government. All of them are important to Washington, but especially one that has influence over others, especially one that has huge reserves of oil, natural gas, and so on, any other valuable resources, and any government that could be allied more east than west is a government to challenge and replace with a pro-Western one. So the plans in Ukraine, in one of my articles I'll put out tomorrow, I quoted somebody. There was an article on Russia Today, RT.com now. I think they were still called Russia Today then, but RT.com, in 2011, that said George Soros was plotting with other, dare I call them, subversive NGOs and business interests and the dark forces in Washington in 2011 during the Libya war, during Obama's war on Libya, to arrange a Libya scenario in Ukraine. A Libya scenario in Ukraine. That may have been the phrase that he used in 2011. So this has been percolating for a long time. I'm convinced that Soros is involved in what's going on. He stands to make a lot of money buying cheap Ukrainian assets at fire sale prices. He did it when the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991. He's done it in other countries. He's not alone. There are other people. I don't have the man's name in front of me right now. It's not a house. Sure, it's practically a household name, but there's another man who, sadly, is connected with Glenn Greenwald and some other people who do the kind of work that he does. He funded a new blog site, putting up some big seed money to get this thing going and put out information, obviously with the intent of controlling it. And the word is, and apparently there's strong evidence indicating that this guy is involved in the turmoil going on in Ukraine because of the profits that he can make if the country goes the way he wants it to go, which is simply opening it up to corporate predation is the best way to put it. They don't care who wins a war; they just want to make money out of it. So if Ukraine gets dead entrapped under the IMF, which is the deal, that's what's coming. That's the second stage of what's already happened. First, you topple the government, and you put a pro-Western groups in, no matter who they are. In this case, they're fascists. They're dangerous fascists, neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, xenophobic maniacs. I mean, really, really a vile bunch of people, and they're taking over. They may be too strong to control. They may end up that way, but they're in charge right now, literally a rogues gallery of people. But the second stage comes in when you start setting up the rules on the path that Ukraine will take going forward. And number one, Ukraine is bankrupt. It needs money. Russia had promised $15 billion by buying Ukrainian bonds. It already kicked in a few billion, as I understand, but it won't kick in another dime, not to a government like this. So what's the next step? Go to the IMF. What are IMF terms? The kind of terms no government should ever accept. Privatize state industries at fire sale prices, erase all social benefits, mass unemployment, one devastating mandate after another, and cracking down hard on anybody who resists these things. So as bad as things are now, Bob, for ordinary Ukrainians, who certainly don't have things very, very, very good, Ukraine is an impoverished country. People earn some of the lowest wages in Eastern Europe. They certainly don't have a good system going for themselves. But if they think things are bad now, just wait till the IMF gets its hands on Ukraine, and things will get much, much worse. The deprivation will grow. These people who supported this so-called revolution, it wasn't a revolution, it was a coup, but whatever they think it was, the people who supported it, they will awaken. They haven't done it yet. Maybe they will slowly. Maybe they're already beginning too slowly. But they will awaken to realize that they were had, and as bad as things were, or they thought they were, under Yanukovych, they will be much, much worse going forward, besides being run by a bunch of fascist thugs that simply will have no compunction at all about arresting, about harming, about murdering anybody who gets in their way. Imagine looking forward to something like that, Bob.
Yeah, I was going to say they're going to pay for this alignment with the EU and the IMF as opposed to aligning with Russia. I mean, in some cases, perhaps it wouldn't have been the best of deals to align with Russia, but if you're playing with the two devils, which one are you going to choose? And if you're going with the EU and the IMF, they already said publicly of us, of Ukraine, what they wanted. And the first thing that I read that they came out with, the IMF said this specifically, they didn't call it austerity, of course, but they want deep cuts to the state subsidies for consumer energy prices. That's the first thing to go. In other words, they want to come in. They don't want the state paying for that energy. They want to privatize it so that one of the big assets of Ukraine is that whole network of energy pipelines that they've got. So they want that, and they want to privatize it and make money from it. That means take that money out of the state and away from the people. That's the first thing to go, and that's what Ukrainians in large measure rely on. So that will really put a big pinch in the economy. Plus, if they need to finance Ukraine, get them out of that $35 billion debt. By the way, Russia, in the interim, since the coup this past week, withdrew its offer of $15 billion in aid. So after the new alleged new government was installed, Russia pulled out on that agreement to give $15 billion. So now they're in real trouble. The Russians aren't supporting them like they said they would. The EU is coming in saying, okay, we'll try to help you out, but in exchange for that, social programs and state subsidies to the people have to go. Again, it's the war on the people that goes on.
Oh, indeed, a war in the people, Bob. And the pipelines are very, very important, not just for Ukraine, for all of Western Europe. Germany is heavily dependent on Russian natural gas. That's very, very, very interesting in my mind, because the last thing Germany wants to see is anything disrupting the ability of Russia to supply them with the natural gas that they need. Well, now, of course, we'll be coming out of winter, so the need will be much lower than it has been up to now. But there's still a fair amount of cold weather left. If Ukraine does anything to disrupt supplies, I think Germany will absolutely put its foot down, and it's the powerhouse in Western Europe. And if Germany doesn't want anything disrupted, I don't think it's going to happen. Wouldn't it be interesting, Bob, if there was a split among the EU nations on how much support to give to the appalling policies that may be instituted by this fascist government? On the one hand, America, because America isn't affected, isn't reliant on Russian gas, oil, or anything else, but Germany is. I think, other countries in Western Europe. So there could literally be some internal disagreements among EU countries on policies going forward. But again, there's no question what the IMF mandates. It's always the same thing. You make ordinary people pay the price of bailing out bankers, bailing out nations, going forward, letting the big boys make the money, and letting ordinary people who need help not to be hit harder, let them become hurt even more than they already are. And that's the plan ahead for ordinary Ukrainians. I think it'd be very interesting watching this, Bob, because once they realize how much tougher things are going to be, how will they react? And I'll mention one more thing. I wrote an article I got this morning, going back in history a little bit, in Venezuela. Carlos Andres Perez, president of Venezuela twice in the 1970s and then reelected in 1989, a neocon. Well, put him a neoliberal type, but in his campaign, he called getting in bed with the IMF a neutron bomb that only kills people. And as soon as he got in office, Bob, I wrote about this because the 27th was the anniversary of a rebellion against his government, and it was a rebellion that literally created Hugo Chavez. It turned into a 1992. It turned into Chavez led a failed rebellion against Perez, but it literally launched him. It launched his career, and Bolivarianism came later in 1999. It took a little while. Chavez actually went to prison, but he got out. But I wrote about the anniversary and the fact that Perez broke his promise, and the people were enraged. One of the things he did was overnight, the 27th of February in 1992 was on a Monday. Over the weekend, he doubled gasoline prices. Can you imagine commuters Monday morning going to work, wanting to fill up their tank, and gasoline cost twice as much? Well, they were furious about it. Some of them wouldn't pay, but the key thing was that fury over the doubling of gasoline prices turned into a rebellion. Will something like that happen in Ukraine, I wonder?
It could. I think it very easily could. I'm going to make a quick comment before it gets too far away. You had mentioned George Soros and his involvement in this. My first thought regarding that, I had two thoughts. One was, I wonder if Soros has in mind some of the heavy industry that goes on in Ukraine. I mean, they're very much an industrial nation, and they produce a lot. So I wonder if he's got an eye on tapping into some of that, perhaps, in addition to the energy issue. The second thing I thought was, he's the major, of all the individual significant funders, he's the major individual funder of Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! So I wonder what Amy's going to do about that. So at least that's the way it has been, unless that has changed in the last year. So he was one of the main funders of Democracy Now! So it'd be interesting to see how that goes as well.
Well, I gave up on Democracy Now! A long time ago. They blow hot and cold. Sometimes they have good reports, but all too often they suck up to the wrong side. And, of course, it's because of Soros money, Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, you know, the corporate money. You get in bed with the corporate with the corporate scoundrels, and you come out smelling pretty rotten and getting yourself very, very dirtied. Indeed, Soros has his eye on very potentially lucrative assets in Ukraine, Bob. And most of the industry is in the East that is very, very pro-Russian. So that's another wrinkle thrown in. Also, the rich agricultural land, I believe most of that, Ukraine has some of the richest agricultural land in the world. And a lot of it is not really being utilized at all or properly. So there's a lot of that to be used. Agribusiness, U.S. agribusiness, I guess European agribusiness, wants to get their dirty hands on this land. So in other words, sell off that land at fire sale prices, sell off Ukrainian industry at fire sale prices, and you can bet you that Soros wants to get his hands on that. I'm certain that Ukraine is such a plum, I can't imagine that he isn't involved. He did it in Hungary, he did it in Czechoslovakia, he did it in Poland, I think he did it in other former Soviet republics. Ukraine is the most important one. You bet you he's in there, Bob.
Sure. You know, what I was thinking when you said that was, I'm not sure if my history is right about this, somebody can correct me if that's not the case, but I think that Ukraine has only been invaded twice in the 20th century, and both times Germany came in because they had their eyes on exactly that, not necessarily the energy thing, but on Ukrainian land and Ukrainian industry. I think it was at both World Wars, somewhere around 1918, around 1941 or so. They've been invaded twice by Germany in order to get those very things, and now they're being invaded by Germany and the United States. They just haven't sent troops there yet, as far as we know. So, and I'm sure that Soros and the others, these people I talked about at the very beginning of the program, the capitalist elites who want a cut of that money, I'm sure they're at the round table making those plans to do that.
Indeed, Bob. Well, I have an unconfirmed report, and it really is unconfirmed. It could be right, it could be wrong, but the report that I will include in one of my articles for tomorrow is that I don't know how many, but NATO troops have arrived in western Ukraine in and around the area of Lviv. Lviv is a hotbed of anti-Yanukovych sentiment, a hotbed as much as Kiev, maybe even more so. But the report that I saw, and I wish there was some citation confirming it, giving me a more positive read on it, but I would say it is very, very possible that NATO forces, I don't know which ones they are, NATO means from any one of 28 countries, are U.S. forces there, are German forces there, British, French, I don't know. But I'm really going to be watching that and looking for any more information, and if I get it, I'll write about it. But that would be another very, very dangerous wrinkle, and all of it just escalates the thing much closer to a very, very dangerous east-west confrontation, and
well,
that's what we face.
We're not sending troops, we're sending military advisors. We're not sending troops anymore anywhere. Military advisors and a bunch of drones.
We'll call them heavily armed military advisors.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way always. Well, I think the advisors have been around for a good while. I'm sure CIA is involved. Certainly the Pentagon is very, very much involved. U.S. Special Forces. I can remember a couple of times writing about U.S. forces being sent. The Washington Post, in fact, wrote about this at least two or three years ago, that when Petraeus was head of forces, I believe, oh, I forget his title, but it was in the Middle East. He was either still in Iraq or still in Afghanistan, or maybe commander in the region. I think he was regional commander, and I forget the precise title. But he was the one who made it publicly known that U.S. Special Forces were being sent or were already deployed in something like 120 countries worldwide. U.S. Special Forces, I mean, these guys are trained killers. They go in to destabilize things, so you can bet you that Ukraine was a key target to send these forces into. So I would imagine, Bob, that U.S. Special Forces have been in Ukraine for a good, good while, probably in Kiev, maybe in the western Lviv area, maybe in other places. And if they're undercover, they could be anywhere. They could be in Crimea. And that's what a self-defense force was formed in Crimea, to search out infiltrators. They used the phrase, quote-unquote, visitors, meaning anybody from outside their own area. It could be from western Ukraine. It could be from a western country. It could be from any country that could be hostile. And they're looking for these people to do something to get rid of them. I mean, not take them on and shoot them, but they're trying to protect themselves because they can see what's coming.
Yeah, that's one thing I neglected to mention, forgot about this when I was talking about Hagel's new budget. He wants a significant increase in the budget for special forces as opposed to the regular forces, and that's exactly the people you're just talking about. If you can get special forces in, you can actually do that without having to have Congress or the President be involved in some type of declaration of hostility or war. You just send special forces in, and you can do that whenever you want. And that's exactly the people that you're talking about there. So it's the new military. It's the underground military, as it were. It's not committing troops so that you don't get the scenes of coffins or anything coming home. It's a very different thing. And it's the same thing going on in Venezuela that we see. We know the CIA is in Venezuela, and everybody has written that writes about it has talked about that pretty openly, that Venezuela, well, the two major intellectual authors of this latest Venezuelan protest and violence were Leopoldo Lopez and Maria Corina Machado. And we know that both of those are very heavily supported by the CIA, and we know their hand in there from previous commentators and their writing on that. So we probably have the special forces there, too, since these right-wing protesters that are creating violence there are being done through the auspices of the United States once again. And the governments of Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, Venezuela, what they call the Mercosur governments, released a statement this week condemning all of that the Venezuelan violence fomented by another country, unnamed, we know who that is, attempts to destabilize the democratic order of Venezuela. So these special forces are all around the place. And it's all part of this notion of regime change, that a lot of it comes out of the State Department. You know, the guy who threw his medals on the White House lawn, John Kerry, has just did that complete flip-flop, and now he completely embraces regime change, including in Venezuela. So you know the special forces are there as well.
Yeah, indeed, Bob. Special Forces, CIA, and the two figures you mentioned, Machado and Leopoldo Lopez, they both were involved in the aborted 2002 April coup all that time ago, and yet they've remained free. Lopez was charged with multiple crimes. He's in detention right now. I'm certain he'll go on trial. What will happen to him, I don't know. But he was arrested. He seemed to surrender himself publicly and proudly because he went out publicly when it was known there was a warrant for his arrest, and he addressed an anti-government rally, and he was arrested, put in detention, but he faces very, very serious charges. If he's convicted, he could spend the rest of his life in prison, unless heaven forbid, the Bolivarian government, Nicolas Maduro's government, gets overthrown, and a government similar to what's going on in Ukraine gets installed. But there are very dangerous elements operating in Venezuela, and the latest, it's been going on, violent protests have been going on for weeks now, since the beginning of February. So we're getting around a month that these things have been going on. They're in a fairly small number of areas, Bob. They're certainly not in the poorer areas. You go into the barrios of Caracas and other cities, and it's very, very calm, the stuff that I've read and mentioned in articles. But it's more in middle-class areas. You get students of more well-off families. You get people being recruited. Of course, you got the very hostile element, the former elites of Venezuela, who profited so well before Bolivarianism was established, and they want to return Venezuela to its bad old days because they'll make tons of money if that happens. So they're involved in this. You get U.S. State Department funded groups. You get CIA, National Endowment for Democracy, International Republican Institute, groups like this, money pouring into Venezuela, tens of millions of dollars over the years, over 15 years, Bob. I wonder how many billions of dollars have been spent to destabilize the country, and they couldn't get rid of Chavez. They certainly couldn't do it electorally. He and Maduro combined won 18 of 19 elections. And, I mean, they just wiped out the opposition. The last presidential election was close. I'm very surprised at how close it was. The follow-up parliamentary election, it was a wipeout. Not a complete wipeout, but overwhelmingly supported the Bolivarian government, with governorships and mayors and so on, municipal officials being solid pro-government. So they can't do it that way. The only way they can do it disruptively, and the latest death count that I saw, it's up to 18 in 3 or 4 weeks or so. I mean, that's pretty serious stuff. In Ukraine, I saw numbers up to 100 over 3 months or so. So we've got 18 in Venezuela. I mean, people, you got people in Ukraine, they were insurgents, we can call them insurgents, they were insurgents, fascists, snipers on rooftops, in windows, picking off people on the street, and the Yanukovych government was wrongfully blamed for their murder. Well, the same thing is going on in Venezuela. You've got these disruptive elements that are shooting people, causing great instability, and it's wrongfully blamed on Nicolas Maduro, the president. There was a thuggish group that broke through the gate of a governor in Táchira state. It's one of 27, I believe, Venezuelan states. This one borders on Colombia. Colombia is very, very pro-U.S., extremely pro-U.S. Their former president, Alvaro Uribe, a fascist, Bob, if there ever was one, a thug, a war criminal, a drug trafficker. It's hard to say anything. His rap sheet is so bad, it's hard to know when to stop. But apparently he's involved in this, trying to destabilize Venezuela. So you get these two states bordering each other, and elements are filtering through. And these people attacked the government's home, broke through the main gate, got inside, threatened the governor's wife. They were throwing Molotov. Imagine in any city in America or a state capital across Europe, wherever people listen to this program, imagine if thugs broke in to a municipal or a government headquarters, started lobbing Molotov cocktails around, throwing rocks and bricks and pieces of cement, maybe came in armed and started shooting people. Can you imagine what would happen in America if this happened, Bob? You'd see the Marines out there just mowing people down in the streets.
With complete impunity as well. And so you see that, I mean, you can envision that in the United States happening quite easily if there is any type of uprising like that. And yet when Maduro tries to address those protesters by arresting people individually who they see committing crimes by throwing things at police and burning cars or throwing Molotov cocktails, whatever they're doing, John Kerry says, well, we're really disturbed that the Venezuelan government is arresting and detaining these anti-government protesters. So he completely ignores everything that you just talked about and just said, oh, it's all Venezuelan government's fault. Again, more efforts to delegitimize and destabilize the Bolivarian government. And there's a lot of discontent with the Bolivarian revolution, the Bolivarian movement. There's a lot of discontent with that right now because of the economic situation. And in part, that's the global situation. In part, it's the sabotage of their economy by the capitalist elites who want their country back so that they can make more money. It's all part of this big thing. But I think that one thing that I see Maduro starting to do, which I think is going to be a big mistake, he's trying to kind of cozy up to these alleged democratic right-wingers so that he can kind of embrace them a bit more so that he can slow down the violence. I think that's a big mistake because Chavez never did that. I mean, the Chavez majority got behind him because he stood up to them. He didn't try to cater to them at all or coddle them at all. But that's what I think Maduro is starting to do from what I've been able to see. And that plays right into the hands of the United States, right into the hands of Leopoldo Lopez to destabilize the Bolivarian movement and ultimately undermine the government. And I think that's what the whole game is.
Yeah, that really is a very dangerous thing to be doing. I don't know exactly what he's doing, Bob, but I've read the same things. There really are two opposition camps, so we're getting very close to the end of the program. Two opposition camps. One is the violent one, and the other one is the man who contested Maduro and lost in the presidential election, Enrique Capriles. He's taking a nonviolent course. He wants to set himself up as a, he's no moderate, but he wants to come off looking like a moderate. He doesn't want to talk to Maduro. The other side doesn't want to talk to Maduro. So even though Maduro is reaching out with an olive branch, he's not having it returned to him. So it could be that nothing will come of this. But I think he needs to take a hard enough stand. And I agree, it's very important to know that a lot of the hardships that the Venezuelans are going through right now are being manipulated from the outside. Stuff is being hoarded, so prices go up. People are suffering because of this. They can't get enough of the things that they need in daily life. But the government is trying to cope as well as they can. I just hope he's able to do it. When the dark knives go out after you, Bob, it's very, very tough. And I remember the phrase that Nixon used talking about Chile in 1973, the Pinochet coup, ahead of the Pinochet coup, where he said he wanted to make the Chilean economy scream. So it had a wonderful governor out of Salvador Allende, and indeed the economy was made to scream, and I think that's exactly what's happening now. I hope it won't end up with the same result. You get the last comment, Bob. We're just about out of time.
Okay, one of the things that, when you mentioned we're almost out of time, one of the things I do want to bring up is that there is something going on that's kind of under the table, and that is Israel. Israel attacked the Lebanese government, or installations in the Lebanese border with Syria on Monday, and then turned around and made a warning to the Lebanese government saying, you're responsible for any response to our bombing. In the meantime, Amnesty International has a report criticizing Israel's slaughter of civilians as war crimes.
Indeed so, Bob. I'm very well aware of what you just said, and it's very, very important. Can you imagine a Middle East war breaking out at the same time we get something big happening in Ukraine? My goodness. I'm glad I'm not young, Bob. Many, many thanks for coming. There's so much more to talk about. I look forward to getting you back. We certainly will continue the story lots more. Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome, Stephen. Thank you for having me.